Morning. So last time we talked about a little about cache alignment. So we mentioned that when we are thinking about caches, we needed to have values sort of starting with cache blocks in order to not have things cross cache blocks. We mentioned compilers did that. And also, this was kind of a consideration if we were kind of manually counting cache misses, which is something we looked a lot about. We said, okay, let's say we're accessing an array. How does that actually map to our cache? We talked about, oh, when we have an array, we can kind of look at the elements of the array, and often more than one of them will fit in a cache block, and those cache blocks will be assigned to sets in the cache, and kind of the general pattern, if the one block is assigned to set 0, then the next part of the array is assigned to set 1, and so on until we run out of sets in the cache, and then we wrap around. And we saw doing this that we could kind of precisely count how many cache misses we'd have for data accesses from, for example, some C code, and therefore think about, oh, if we have two different ways of writing this, which one is likely to at least be better for the cache? And then we looked at, okay, well, that's something we can do, but when we have non-trivial code, that really gets really annoying. So we had these more approximate ways of analyzing how many misses there would be. And to do that, we kind of did this looking at temporal and spatial locality very broadly. So we said, okay, when there's good temporal locality, that generally means we're going to have a miss the first time we access something, and then hits if we've accessed it before. When there's good spatial locality, that means we're going to have a miss the first time we access something, a block, and a hit the other times. And if our block holds k items, that's 1 over k of the times we're going to have a miss. And we can use this to kind of estimate how many cache misses we're going to have in some code without doing that precise, what set does this go to? Does this go to the same set as other things? Analysis. Now, this is an estimate because we aren't accounting for things like, what if we have lots of conflict misses because all the index bits happen to be the same? Kind of ignoring that. And we started by looking at, oh, okay, so one thing that comes up when we have code that accesses big matrices and arrays is that we have kind of often this nested loop structure. And one thing we can do is change the order of those loops. And we found that often this kind of is a compromise as far as locality goes, that by changing whether we're doing a loop in one of the dimensions versus another, will make some things have better locality and some things have worse locality, because, for example, we'll switch from going down a row to going down a column, and if our rows are stored together, the rows will have better spatial locality, or we'll switch from accessing something over and over again to multiply it or add it or do something with it with another thing, which would have good temporal locality versus iterating through all the things we're going to apply to the other thing, which would have worse temporal locality. And with this compromise, we're going to talk today about, well, do we have to really have that compromise? And we're going to look particularly at the example of matrix multiply, because this is one of the most common problems and kind of illustrates the ideas we might have for making better use of our cache. That's what we're going to move on to today. So questions before I talk about that? So last time we were dealing with this code here, and you can see here that we have this kind of loop that does a matrix multiply, where we have these individual steps where we do an addition and a multiply. And I'm going to do a little transformation here. And my first step of my transformation, I'm not going to change anything. We're going to do everything in the same order we did before. All I've done is I've written the loop over k in a really funny way. That instead of accessing, doing k plus equals 1, I'm doing k plus equals 2, and then I'm setting k to be k plus 0, and then k plus 1. Or kk plus 0 and kk plus 1. So we're going through the exact same values in the exact same order. I'm just doing this in this funny way where I have a starting point, I'm incrementing by 2, and then I'm going from that starting point, so it's initially 0, I do 0, 1, then the starting point's 2, I do 2, 3, then the starting point's 4, I do 4, 5, and so on. So this is exactly the same order as before. I haven't changed anything yet. But the reason I'm doing this is because our next step is going to be to reorder these loops. So that the first thing we tried doing is like to affect the locality was we moved around these loops. We said, oh, what if we put this K loop was had it in the middle? What if we put it on the outside? We're going to do the same kind of transformation with our new set of loops. And so what I've done is I've moved that the second loop in my new set to the middle. So I'm doing the same calculations because our addition and multiplication, our addition is commutative. But now I have different locality because I've changed the order. And I've changed the order in a different way than we could have done with the original loops by just reordering them. So right now, notably, if I look at my loop, I can kind of expand it, and we can look at what locality is there. So I have my loop here. I'm going to expand it by just writing out the two iterations of that inner loop, just so we can look more clearly at what locality do we have. And we can see that we have repeated accesses to the same element of C. And we could have seen that here by saying, oh, this thing here, this does not depend on what K is. And the K is the only thing that changes. I have accesses to consecutive elements of K. And that's of A, rather. And that's because K was our last, our sort of index into the row, the column number, and the restoring rows together. And now that's what changes in this most inner code, which previously didn't before, because previously we were going in J. So I have a little spatial locality in K, in A. And in B and C, for spatial locality, like, it's not great. Like, I've made it worse here. Like, because we're accessing two different elements of B that are far apart. So that's not good spatial locality. But I'm only doing two. I'm not doing, like, N. So we still have some spatial locality in that if I look at this access to B here, I'm going to access something else that's going to be next to it soon. When is soon? When I go to the next J. And I'm going to do that pretty soon because there's only two things I'm doing in this loop, in this inner loop here, that after I've expanded it. And what we've done overall here is by doing this transformation, we've gotten better overall locality than we had in any of the versions where we swapped around what loop was where in the original. So let's go through counting what our misses are, doing sort of an approximate miscounting. So if we think of A, we're accessing A of 0, A of 1, A of n, A of n plus 1, and so on, and then going back to A of n, A of n plus 1, A of n, A of n plus 1, and doing that pattern. So if we think about how many misses we have, well, we can say that kind of each time we do this, we're going to have one miss, assuming that these two values are in the same block. So only on the first iteration of the loop here over J. If we look at B, our pattern is we're doing B of 0, B of n, B of 1, B of n plus 1, B of 2, and so on. So we can say, not n plus B of 0, B of n. Do I do this wrong? No. So we're going to have sort of cache misses equal to the number of cache blocks in each of the two rows we're scanning, because we're scanning over two rows each iteration. So we expect to have sort of 2n over the block size misses per iteration. And we have n squared n over 2, because we're doing k plus equals 2. So if we look at our loops here, how many times do we run this? We run it n over 2, because that's how many times this loop over k runs, this kk loop here, times n times n. And for the inner loop, we've determined that we have 2n over the block size misses, because we're scanning two rows, so we're accessing 2n items, but they should be together in cache blocks, so we divide by the block size, because every one over the block size elements, we're going to have a miss to load that block, and then the next accesses are they're in the same block, so they're not misses. And I get for b that there's n cubed divided by the block size misses. So if I look at do this analysis again for C, I'm going to get that, okay, we look at the accesses to C, we have one per iteration of this sort of J loop, we have one per iteration of this J loop, but we have spatial locality, so we have one divided by the block size per iteration of the J loop, because each time we're having a new J loop, we're doing accessing something that's adjacent to what we did in the previous one. So when I count misses, I say, okay, for the C, we're getting n cubed, number of iterations of that loop, divided by 2 times the block size. So n cubed over 3 is the number of iterations, divided by the block size. For B, I'm getting n cubed divided by the block size, which is just saying, okay, we have n cubed over 3 iterations, but we have 2n for each of that our loop with that does two things, divided by the block size. And for A, we have n squared divided by the block size, because we're accessing these two elements of A in each of the n cubed over 3 loop, the loops over n squared over 3 loops that account for these first two for loops. And you see we've gotten an improvement in the accesses to A and C, and we've done that without hurting B. Whereas previously when we were adjusting loop orders, when we changed things, we didn't get this kind of compromise. But this still isn't great, because if we kind of add these up, we're going to say that we have n squared, over 2. Yes, I probably should not try to do this without a pen. So if we add these up, we're going to say, okay, we have about n cubed over the block size-ish misses. So we haven't improved the order overall, but we can keep doing this. And what we've done here already improves the number of misses. We can see that by running it. So I ran this and counted the number of misses for the two versions. The version I've labeled as blocked. We'll see why we call this blocking in a bit. And yes, that's kind of an overloaded term. We'll talk about that in a bit. That version has about half the misses. Now, I'm counting misses and not performance, because it turns out it's not yet much faster. But when we do more of this, we'll get it to be faster. So questions about this transformation we did and why it improves our number of misses. Okay, so we did this transformation with K, where we said, okay, instead of accessing things with different Ks only very far apart, we're going to access a couple of them together per iteration. We can also do that with I. So here we go. We just did it. I just did that same transformation, not just only with K, but also with I. And if we think of how this loop expands, now in these sort of small number of accesses, we're accessing to the same element of B twice, where previously we said, oh, B wasn't improved at all. Well, now we're improving B because we're accessing two things with the same element of B, and that's because if we look at the access to B, it doesn't depend on the index I, so now I have temporal locality there. Oops. So we can do the same kind of thing to count misses. So now the number of times this J loop runs is n squared over 4. And for A, we have kind of two cache blocks that we're going to need to access each time we have a loop, each time we run this J loop, because it doesn't depend on J. So we have n squared over 2 misses in total, n squared over 4 times 2. For B, we have these accesses to things that, as J increases, are going to be in the same block, and we have two of them. So we have 2 divided by the block size misses per iteration of the loop. So we have n cubed divided by 2 divided by the block size misses. And for C, I don't think we've changed anything. We have two things we're accessing, and they're going to be in the same block as we go increase J, because we're going across a row. So we're going to have 2 divided by the block size misses per iteration there. And sort of when we combine these overall, we see that, you know, now I've gotten these factors, which were 1, to be 2, and we should kind of half our number of misses overall. So we'll get, you know, in actuality, we'll get much better performance. So questions on sort of this sort of next step here. Okay, so an observation you might have is I chose to do 2. I have these plus equal 2 here. And that was kind of an arbitrary choice. So how big can I make those numbers? Have this trick still work? Is there some limits? Or if there is a limit, I should say, but why? What is that limit caused by? Yeah. So is it the block size? Not exactly. Something about the cache. So a way of thinking about it is I told you here, we expand this loop, we have good temporal locality in B because we're accessing the same element of B twice in close in time. So that only works because I made these numbers small, so these are actually still close in time. If I make these numbers too big, these accesses aren't going to have reasonable temporal locality anymore because we're going to access too much stuff in between them, and our cache is going to evict this element of B before we access it again. So that's my limit on how big I can make this plus equals 2 or whatever. It needs to be small enough that we're not going to run out of space in your cache, because that's what this analysis was depending on. I was assuming that, if I access that first element of B, later on, it's still going to be there. And with these sizes, that's going to be true unless our cache is teeny, teeny, weeny. But if I want to start making this bigger, more than plus equals 2, we might start running into a problem there. So we need to figure out what the limit is for that. And you might say, why do we want to make this bigger? Well, if we look at the analysis we did, where did our divided by 2 come from? Well, it came from the fact that we kind of managed to have this factor of 2 from the number of iterations we were doing when we had this locality to take advantage of. And if we can make that bigger, that's going to be better. But the problem is we can only make that bigger until we run out of space in the cache for running this. So as long as all this stuff doesn't run out of space in the cache, we're fine. But if it does, this analysis breaks. And we're just back to sort of the situation we started with. Yes?
Can I ask a question? How do you get
how do I get two cache blocks for A here? Yeah, so these two things are in the same cache block. And these two things are in the same cache block. The reason why we know they're in different cache blocks maybe is clearer if we look at this, but you can see that I changes the index by N, so those are far apart, so they shouldn't be in the same cache block. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah, sorry. Question, if you make the two really big, wouldn't it just not access everything? So, yes. So if we make the two really big, we'll get up into a case where there's no locality here, right? Like, where these are so far apart that, well, there is some locality, right? It's better than maybe originally, but it's not good enough to matter with our cache, because what matters for is temporal locality useful when we have a cache is, will it still be in the cache? And if the answer, and if we make it too big, the answer to that's going to be no.
Okay, another question. So this is supposed to be matrix multiplication, correct?
So this example is matrix multiplication, yes.
So we wanted to have good locality, but we also wanted to actually perform the actions, right?
Question, we wanted to have good locality, but we have constraints on, we wanted to perform the actions, yes. So one of the key assumptions I have here is that as long as I do this operation for all the I, J, and K, we'll get the right answer.
Okay.
And from our naive point of view, we'd say, oh, addition's commutative, so that's all I need to worry about. If you talk to people who do scientific computing, they might have other concerns about like floating point stuff, but we're going to ignore those. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we can generalize this, and sort of the general version is that we'll choose kind of a normal arbitrary numbers to increment I, J, and K by for our groups of I, J, and K. So we'll do it in all of them. And then we'll have kind of an inner loop that does a little block. So sort of pictorially, basically we're going to divide up this problem into cases where we're going to do a little rectangle of A, a little rectangle of B, and a little rectangle of C based on our I, J, and K ranges. So we're just going to choose a range of I's, a range of J's, a range of K's, do all of those. And the idea is that we're going to keep these green parts of, you know, these blocks of the matrix in our cache. And as long as these all fit in our cache, that means that this code here, which is calling this sort of partial multiply function, that whole thing is going to happen loading things into cache at most once, rather than before, where each iteration of the loop, we were worried about loading things again and again and again. But our assumption is that, yes, we're going to have to load these values into the cache, but we're going to load them, do everything we can with all of them loaded before we move on. And the bigger we can make these blocks and still have them all loaded in the cache, the better performance we're going to get. But our constraint, of course, is that if we make them too big, we can't load them all in the cache, right? We're going to have a case where we're going to have to swap out parts of, say, the block of A as we're going through the B and C parts, and vice versa. But ultimately, that's the what we're going to end up doing. So we're going to go through, if we think of if our block size is in the I dimension, we're doing groups of capital I. In the J dimension, we're doing groups of capital J. And the K dimension, we're doing groups of capital J. We're going to have kind of N cubed over I times J, big I times big J times big K, blocks of the matrix, sort of parts of these groups of the matrix Zs we're working on. And in that innermost loop of that, where we're doing that sort of one set of blocks, we're going to load, hopefully, into the cache, you know, I times K elements of A, because we're doing A sub I K, K times J elements of B, and I times J elements of C. You know, so we're going to load those at most once. Maybe they're already loaded because, you know, the order we're going, but we're going to load those into our cache, and then you know, we're going to do all the work on them. And so our number of cache misses is just how much time does it take to do all these loading of the values each time we're doing a set of blocks. And we'll have a smaller amount of that the bigger we can make I, J, and K. Yes?
I don't think I quite understand the goal here. So is there a goal to make it so that each part of the program does the minimal work as possible?
So the question, is the goal to make so each part of the program does the minimal work as possible? Yes, for a very particular definition of work. So we're going to do the exact same number of multiplies, the exact same number of adds, but we want to have the least amount of loading things into the cache. And here, how much stuff are we loading into the cache? Well, it's the sum of these values here. So we want to make that sum as small as possible. And how are we going to do that? By making J, I, and K as big as possible. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
My first question is, on this slide, like, I'm a little confused about, like, when you're saying block size, if you're talking about, like, a block in the cache or a block in the cache.
Okay, so the question is, I was not super careful about distinguishing blocks in the cache and blocks in the matrix. So, in this slide, I always use the word matrix block when I mean a block in the matrix, and every other instance is a cache block. And if I, yes, unfortunately, I left my pen in Chem 402 on Tuesday, apparently, so just wait, but yes, this is a cache block, this is a cache block, this is a cache block, this is a cache block. And yes, it is unfortunate that these two related concepts use the same term block. But that is what happens in the literature.
I just have one more question.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that I'm understanding. So, like, the concept of the matrix block is, like, we're taking a subset of each matrix, and we're going to try and do all the operations that will depend on that subset of the matrix. That way you only load in those values once.
So the concept of the matrix block is we're taking a subset of the matrix, and that we're trying to do all the operations that depend on that, so we only load those values once. Basically, so we're not actually going to only load it once, because if we think of here, right, this block is chosen based on I, J, and K, right? So when we vary J, we're going to choose the same block part of A multiple times. So we are still going to have to load it multiple times, but a lower number of multiple times, especially if we can make our sort of J block size big. Is that answer your question? Yes?
Do you mind forwarding to the next point? I guess in response to my next question, how can we calculate the sum of each of these processes such that the number of caches are, I don't quite understand how the math works there.
Why do we take the sum of?
Yeah, I it probably sounds stupid, but I'm just, why did that be, why does it work that when we take the sum, that's how we know the amount, how much cash, that how many times cash is active?
So why don't we take the sum of how much cash is active? So I guess, so first thing we need to believe is that we're going to choose, so do we believe in the number up here, right? So each time we load that, do that, we're going to load I times K elements from, so each time we select one of those, so we're going to select a block in A, B, and C, and each time we do that, we're going to load I times K elements of A. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And they're going to have rows together, so we can, as a quick approximation, we can say, because things are in the same row, we can divide by the cache block size. And when we multiply that value times this value, this is what we get here. And this number is not taking into account conflict misses, it's not taking into account that sometimes we're going to maybe use the same part of A for two consecutive sets of blocks. So it's an approximation, but with those caveats, this is the number we get just from that multiplication, or from that multiplication here. And the same thing for B and C. Does that make sense? And so that approximation says that each time we do that, we have to load A, B, and C to do the calculations. And so that's the number of things we have to load, times we have to load a cache block, I should say. And it's kind of an estimate because missing conflict misses, we're missing some locality between different sets of blocks, but you know, it's a reasonable approximation. Yeah?
So basically, doesn't it like improve the algorithmic efficiency? It just improves the use of cache, essentially?
So question, this doesn't improve the algorithmic efficiency, it just improves the use of cache? So approximately, yes. So if you talk to algorithms people, there are ways of sort of measuring cache efficiency in designing your algorithm, but this is not something we typically talk about in any undergraduate algorithms course.
And also,
yeah.
Sorry. So basically, isn't like a general thing that using the divide and conquer approach will improve the use of cache?
Question: is it a general thing that using a divide and conquer approach will improve the use of cache? I don't think I wouldn't say it's generally true, but it often is a good strategy. Yeah.
So, like, for these three matrices, the J times block size, I times block size, and K times block size are the limits that we can achieve in the denominator to, like, prevent overriding to the cache.
So the question, in these three matrices, the J times block size, I times block size, K times block size are the limits we can achieve? Yeah, and that's just based on sort of the how many times we're going to access a block as we iterate through the matrices. Access a matrix block, one of the groups of in K, I times K elements, right? We're going to access each one J times. Kind of. Okay. And sort of, I've been doing this in practice, kind of the rule of thumb for setting I, J, and K is that you kind of want to fill one of the caches. So for example, if you think the cache you wanted to fill on my desktop's L1, which is 32K, I say, okay, if we set them all to 48, that uses about 27K, that's probably about right. In practice, you're gonna have people will just experiment with numbers around sort of that estimate, and they have to sort of figure out, like, do I want to fill the L1 cache or the L2 cache? And which one it's going to be is going to depend on your problem and how fast those caches are and so on. Okay, some questions? Are cache blocking them? So this idea is what is called cache blocking. So this is kind of the most common way people will write code, that to take advantage of caches. It's not the only thing we can do, but it's probably the least obvious one, because more obvious things are like, oh, put two values that you access together so they're in the same cache block. That is a useful thing, but that is sort of kind of a lot more intuitive. But this idea of cache blocking, so basically the idea is that, like, if we can think about, oh, what order do I want to do these things in, often we'll find out, well, there's no great order. And if there's not a great order, we can often do this idea where we work in these matrix blocks to have a compromise between, oh, I can't do doing I first then J or J first then I. We can kind of do a mix of the two and often get better performance than we would from either extreme. Okay, some questions about cache blocking. Before I talk about our next topic, which is completely sort of lower level, not cache optimization. Okay, so we've looked a bunch at loop stuff, and we've been mostly concerned with cache. Let's talk about stuff that's not caches. So here I have some code for summing an array. So this function here, we take an array of values via a pointer. We go through each of the values, add it to a sum variable, and return that sum. And here's the code that version of GCC generated with the optimize for size flag. Why optimize for size? So it fits on my slide. So GCC decided to put I in EDX, and sum actually in RDX, and sum in RAX. And our loop, it compares I to size. If it's too big, it goes to the end of the loop. And then it takes the appropriate element of values, adds it to REX, increments RDX, and repeats. That's how it compiled this loop. And this seems pretty good. But we can do better. And, well, it makes sense we can do better because I told GCC to optimize for size. But if we want faster, we can do faster. So let me do something faster. And the observation I'm making here is that, oh, in this original loop, I have a bunch of instructions here that aren't doing the actual work of the loop. I have four instructions that all they're doing is bookkeeping. And for each of those instructions, I'm only doing one actual piece of real work. So my observation is maybe I could do more real work each time, but do this roughly the same amount of bookkeeping. And sort of that's my idea here, is that I'm going to expand my loop to, rather than doing one piece of work per iteration, to do two. But the bookkeeping is basically the same. It's not quite the same because now I need to increment I by 2. And there's something I didn't write here, which is if I is odd, I need to handle the leftover, right? Because I'm going to go, okay, I'm one off in the case where size is odd. So I need to have some code if size is odd to handle that case that I haven't dealt with yet. But we can see as long as size is pretty big, that code to handle the leftover stuff is not going to be a big deal. If size is like 1,000, who cares if we run 5 extra instructions to handle that leftover? And as far as this loop goes, if size is 1,000, in this top version, I'm running 5,000 instructions. In this bottom version, I'm running around 1,000 divided by 2, 500 times 6, 3,000 instructions. So I saved 2,000 instructions. And yes, that 2,000, I'm just going to subtract the enough for the leftover, but if that's like 20, which would be a ton, I still saved a ton of instructions. So this works a lot better. So this idea is called loop unrolling. We're kind of, if we think of like having a little parchment with our loop, we're expanding it to just have more copies of the loop body, as we say, the actual work of the loop. And we're adjusting the bookkeeping on the loop to make that work. And I've kind of shown it in assembly because that makes it clearest sort of why it's beneficial, that it actually runs less instructions to do the same work. So questions about kind of loop unrolling from an assembly point of view? Yeah?
I think that in loop 6 already, does this have anything to do with improving cache performance, or this is like...
Question, does this have anything to do with improving cache performance? No. I will talk explicitly about how this relates to cache blocking because there's some common confusion. But why doesn't this change cache performance? Well, let's look at, can someone tell me where are the things that access the cache here? The data cache, I should say.
The add instructions are accessing
the okay. Okay, so these are the instructions accessing the data cache. We also have instructions that access the instruction cache, but it's basically the same for both. So for the data cache accesses, we're accessing values of 0, values of 1, values of 2, values of 3. In the second one, we're accessing values of 0, values of 1, values of 2, values of 3, values of 4. It's the same accesses to the cache. As far as the cache is concerned, for the data cache is concerned, these are basically the same as far as what it can see. For the instruction cache, yeah, things are a little different, but we're not getting most of our benefit from having better instruction cache performance. We're getting it from just having fewer instructions to run. Yeah?
So our overall goal with the loop unrolling is to all the bookkeeping like jump and anything that's a regular part of the condition, we're going to try to somehow... What are you doing with those to reduce the number of instructions?
So the question, what are we changing about the bookkeeping? We reduce the number of instructions we're doing. So basically I said, I'm gonna do two loop bodies per iteration instead of one. Okay. And my bookkeeping is based on the number of iterations I have of going through the loop, not the number, not what I actually becomes. So I do this basically the same amount of bookkeeping, except that I'm gonna need to handle the case where the number of iterations is not a multiple of two. So basically, I just modified my loop to do more work per iteration, and I adjusted the indexing to skip by instead of one by two, because I'm doing twice the work. Okay. And I could expand this to do three times the work and skip by three instead of two, and so on. Okay. Yeah?
So the purpose of this loop unrolling is to try to minimize the running time by doing
So question, the purpose of this loop unrolling is to try to minimize the running time? Yes. So our hope is that running less instructions will run faster. Yes?
Is this also limited the same way as the other form of like the number of times you can have accessing? Is there also a limit to that?
So question, is there a limit to that? We will get to that later. That is a good, but yes, we'll get to that question later. And the answer, of course, there is some limit, but we'll talk about what it is practically later. Okay, so we can also kind of represent this in C. I started with assembly because, well, the C could be compiled in multiple ways, and I wanted to clearly illustrate like why on the machine level is the loop unrolling likely to be faster. But this is sort of C that represents, corresponds to the assembly we just showed. It also shows like what the code for handling the leftover might be. So in this case, I changed my loop to stop if we have sort of a leftover piece by making it I plus one less than n instead of I less than n. And then I have an extra if statement to handle if it was odd number, if size was odd. Just to make sure we get the same answer after doing a little less work for bookkeeping. And we can do this more times. So I can like do four at a time by increment doing four. And I again have roughly the same number of bookkeeping because all my bookkeeping instructions to implement this four structure basically gonna be the same number of instructions as before. So now I have those same four-ish instructions, but I'm now doing four adds instead of just one for every one. So I'm gonna get the adds done more efficiently. And we can measure the performance. So I tested this on my laptop with 992 elements. I chose that size because I know it fits the L1 cache. So there's no cache misses here because everything's small enough to fit in all the caches. And I did more and more unrolling. So I started with the non-unrolled version. So I'm doing one add per iteration. Then I did 2, 4, 8, 16, and 32. And I measured the number of instructions per element and the number of cycles per element. And you can see that the number of instructions per element keeps going down. The number of cycles per element works a little differently. So it goes down, and then it kind of plateaus at around 1. And 1 is something that our textbook calls a latency bound. And if you think about how our pipeline processor worked, with our pipeline processor, this doesn't make sense, right? How could we run fewer and fewer instructions and have the performance stay the same? And the reason why this is happening is that my laptop processor is something a little different than a pipeline processor. It does pipelining, but it also does some other stuff, and we're gonna talk about that soon to explain like why this is happening. But this also illustrates that, even though like we could keep unrolling, there's not really much advantage to going too far, right? We're not going to get any extra performance, it turns out. Questions? This performance. Okay, so, and I promise I get to the question of how does this relate to our cache blocking stuff? And I'd like to talk about one issue with that, about let's look at our matrix multiply and look at what loop unrolling would do on that. So here is loop unrolling on the matrix multiply. What I did here is I took our naive code here that has an inner loop in J, and I just now have the loop in J, do J plus equals 2. But I haven't changed the order, right? We're still, we think of the axis pattern. We're accessing C of 0, 0, A of 0, 0, B of 0, 0, C of 0, 1, C of A of 0, 0, B of 0, 1. And the access pattern's the same in the new version. Meaning that as far as the cache is concerned, I'm doing the same thing in both of these. I've changed how I do the bookkeeping for it. So yes, the second version is going to be probably a little faster, especially if we don't have many cache misses. But as far as the cache is concerned, I'm accessing the same elements of A, B, and C in the same order. It's going to have the same misses, the same performance for the cache. Yes, the other stuff might be better, but the same. And this is just because I didn't change, I changed how my loop indexing worked, but I didn't change the ordering of the accesses at all. When I did this cache blocking thing, I changed the order, right? I have my loop over K, now I'm accessing things with different order of Ks. Previously, I was accessing K equals 0 stuff, then accessing all the K equals 0 stuff before we moved on to K equals 1. With this version, I'm accessing K equals 0 stuff, then K equals 1 stuff, then K equals 2 stuff, all the way up to K plus block size before I move on to the next set of stuff. And we could do loop unrolling with that. And commonly, it's a very good idea. So here, I've done loop unrolling on this loop. And I had a special case here. This loop runs exactly 2 times. So when I unroll it to have 2 copies of its body, this is what I end up with. I don't end up with a loop anymore, because I just unrolled it completely. It's great. And that's going to really improve our performance, because not only am I doing less bookkeeping per iteration, I'm doing less bookkeeping. So that's great. And that's just an extreme case of loop unrolling. But this came from doing this transformation here. Because I'm accessing the Ks in a different order than the original, this is doing cache blocking and loop unrolling together. That's how I got the code at the bottom. Right. I didn't just do loop unrolling because I changed the order I access things. I did loop unrolling and cache blocking. So questions? That. And yes?
So if I'm understanding correctly, you're basically the most inner loop and you just split it up. You just pulled it out.
The question, if you're understanding correctly, I took the most inner loop and I just... I just expanded it, yes. So here I did an extreme version of loop unrolling where I said, okay, if I keep unrolling this, I don't need any more bookkeeping. Right. Yeah. So just completely expanded, wrote out the whole loop. And that's an example of loop unrolling. That's sort of the most extreme version. Yeah.
Why is this a cache blocking?
Why is this a cache blocking? Because this version was cache blocking already. Right, so to get to this thing at the bottom, we did cache blocking, then loop unrolling.
And then, what is the original version that is cache blocking is improved?
This is the original code here. So I took this code, and then I did the cache blocking.
And that's the cache blocking.
Yeah, and this spot at the bottom is cache blocking because now I'm doing the Ks in a different order. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that we're going to have an upcoming assignment. And commonly on that assignment, I see students doing this and saying, oh, I did loop unrolling in K. No, that's not what you did. You did a great thing that's going to really help performance, but it's not loop unrolling in K. What you did here is cache blocking and loop unrolling together. If you actually did loop unrolling in K, it would look something like this, right? If we take the loop over K in the original, it's the outer loop, so we do 2 copies of its body. This is not very useful. Like, don't do it. But that's what loop unrolling in K is. What you did here is cache blocking and loop unrolling. It's a good idea, but I have a lot of people say, oh, I did loop unrolling and it really helped the performance. Well, yes, you really helped the performance, but not because you did loop unrolling. It's usually because you did cache blocking. And it's precisely because you change the locality, which cache blocking doesn't do because it's just doing the same work. This change the locality, it's going to help more, but you should know when you're doing it because you want to do it on purpose, not by accident. So let's do a little exercise on that. Question, which one improves the locality? Cache blocking improves the locality, because cache blocking is the only case where we're actually sending different values to the cache, right? With loop unrolling, we're doing the same work, therefore we're sending the same addresses to the cache, because our work is where we're, you know, kind of reading and writing things from the data cache, like if we're going over an array, for example. So here I have some code that does some stuff with some arrays, and I'm asking, I have two transformations of it, I'm asking which of these involves changing the order of memory accesses, if any. Who would like some more time? Keep going. Okay, so let's see. Who thinks A involves changing the order? Thinks A does not involve changing the order? Okay, no clue? Okay, so most people say it does not, and I would say it does not. We're doing A of I equals 0, J equals 0, B, I equals 0, J equals 0, and then we're doing everything for I equals 0, J equals 1. Then we go on to I equals 0, J equals 2, I equals 0, J equals 3, and so on. So it's just what the same stuff the original is doing, but we've expanded, we've sort of do two J's for each loop. But we're doing it in the same order. We're doing I equals 0, J equals 0, I equals 0, J equals 1, I equals 0, J equals 2, and so on. Not moving on to I equals 1 until we do all the J's. In this version, we have something different. So who thinks it does change the order? Thinks it does not? I would say it does. So here we're doing I equals 0, J equals 0. I equals 0, J equals 1. Initially when I and J are 0. Here we're doing the same as I equals 1, J equals 0, I equals 1, J equals 1. So we're skipping to the next I earlier than we did in the original code, right? We're accessing elements based on I plus one if we were looking at the original code earlier in the second version, so it's actually changing the order of the accesses. And it's going to have a difference in how it works with the cache. And I would say probably performs better with the cache, but you know, you'd probably run it to see. Some questions? Okay, so we're going to go back to our little mystery here about why did this kind of performance kind of plateau, even though our number of instructions was keep going down and down. And to talk about this, we're going to talk about some things that seek processors do that our pipeline processor does not. So there's two big things we're going to talk about. One is that modern processors execute multiple instructions at the same time. And I mean at the same time in a stronger sense than the pipeline. So with pipelining, we have multiple instructions running at the same time. You know, in the sense that, you know, we fetch an instruction, and while we're doing the work for that instruction, we're fetching other instructions. Modern processors do more than that. They fetch multiple instructions at the same time. They do additions or other calculations for multiple instructions in the same cycle. And things like that. So a way we can think of this is that, and we're going to use the term here, multiple issue. They issue multiple instructions at the same time. Not only are they happening at the same time, they're starting at or doing their work at the same time. So a simple way you can think of it is we have, you know, a way we could build this is we could build multiple copies of our pipeline with one big shared register file. And one big, which instead of having, like, being able to read two registers at once, could read four registers at once. Instead of writing two registers at once, could write four registers at once. And this is kind of what we do, and we have to do all the forwarding. So now instead of needing to forward from, you know, whatever instructions in the execute stage to the code, we need to forward from whatever of the two instructions in the execute stage to the two instructions in the code. So our hazard handling logic becomes way more complicated. But this is kind of an idea we can implement. And the hope is that, like in this example, we'll have bunches of instructions that are sufficiently independent of each other that we can actually run them at the same time. So questions on this sort of high level idea. So we're going to start more than one instruction per cycle, gives us this name multiple issue, and we're going to have basically multiple copies of our pipeline or bigger components so we can do actually multiple instructions work. And the cost here and why we didn't have you implement it is that the hazard handling is a lot of work. So the other thing they do is they execute instructions out of order. So you might say, why would we want to do this? And caches give us one reason, that if we think of how our caches work, when we have a cache miss, that can take a while. And with our pipeline design we implemented for the homework, the way we'd handle that is by just not doing anything until the value came back. But what if instead we could just run some other instructions? So here I have, we, you know, start one instruction per cycle, but when we have a slow instruction, like this mrmoveq here, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to run instructions that don't depend on it while we're waiting. And I'll let the subtract instruction here, you know, that depends on it, I'll run it when the value's ready. And this is really good, you know, if instead of it being 3 cycles to get the value, it's maybe like 50. No problem. Like, we can run lots of other stuff as long as it doesn't need something based on R8. Now, the challenge here is that if we're implementing this, we still want to make it look like we're running one instruction at a time. We want the same numbers. We don't want, if there's some code down here that uses R9, that it's going to get the wrong value. So we're going to have much more complicated hazard handling logic, and we'll give you sort of high-level overview of how that works. Also, I have this extra sort of pipeline stage here labeled C, we're going to have some step to finalize instructions, because as part of our hazard handling logic, we're going to have to keep track of instructions until we're completely finished with them. And that's what the C stage for commit stands for, that we're going to finalize the instruction in an in-order way. So we're fetching the instructions in the order they appear in the program, and we're committing them. But in the middle, we do the work whenever it's ready. The commit is like to finish the instruction, do all our bookkeeping to know that, OK, this instruction's actually done. Everything before it's ready, we can actually finish it. But we're going to have sit on all the work beforehand and as the values are available. Yeah.
So if IQ and XOR Q like finish earlier, but the C stage would have to wait after MRM starts.
The question is, if IQ and XOR Q finish earlier, the C state would have to wait until after? Yes. And when we talk about exceptions, we'll see the main reason why we want this sort of extra finishing state. But basically, we want some way of making sure that, let's say you're in a debugger, right? We want some way of letting the debugger get, you know, what the state of the program is here, so we need to know when is that rate. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Is this the same thing as concurrency? So this is a form of what is often called instruction-level parallelism. It's kind of the general term. I wouldn't say it's concurrency, because with concurrency, we're usually thinking about mostly independent things. But it's related to concurrency. Okay, so this out-of-order execution idea creates a bunch of problems that are going to make hazards a lot more work to handle. So one of them is for forwarding, that when we're forwarding in our pipeline processor, the way we figure out what values to forward is we just look at what stage does it come from, and if it comes from the most recent stage, it's the most up-to-date value. That's no longer going to be true, right? Because here, I have stuff in the write-back stage that is not from as recent as an instruction as previously, versus like this write-back stage here. If this might be an old value of R9, we have to take that into account. We'll have an example of that. It also makes branch prediction a bunch more complicated, because now we can have, you know, branch prediction matters a lot more in these processors, because we can go way, way further ahead of our branch prediction of our branch instruction before we figure out its results. Especially like if we have a conditional jump that like depends on a value loaded from the cache. If that cache load takes 50 cycles, well, we need 50 cycles to figure out if our branch prediction was correct. So now for squashing, we need to handle squashing 50 cycles worth of work if we got the prediction wrong. And also we need to figure out, like, how do we figure out what instructions are ready? Like I just showed us here, figuring out, oh, this sub-Q depends on R8, but we need to have sort of general logic for that. We're going to talk about sort of what does that look like? How do we make that kind of feasible to make? Not going to say easy, but feasible. So let's go over sort of some examples of, like, why is the hazard handling more complicated? So in our normal pipeline, here I could get R8 from the first add or the second add for the third add to run, but we'll get it from the second one because it comes from the most recent stage. But if we think of out-of-order execution, this idea might not quite work anymore. So here I have an IR move queue that and an add queue that both set R8. And let's say this add queue here is delayed because R10 probably, you know, comes from something that's slow. In that case, you know, if we just forward from the most recent stage, we'll say, oh, let's take this value of R8 here. But it's not the right one, right? The value of R8 we want for this last add instruction is the one from the IR move queue. So if we just forward from the execute stage when we can, and if not from the memory and so on, like you did in your pipeline processor, that's not going to work anymore. We need to have some sort of bookkeeping that figures out, oh, the IR move queue instruction, that's the version of add we care about. R8 we care about, not the one from that old add queue. And notice that in this example, we can't just like say this R8 doesn't matter because, well, it does, right? It's being overwritten, but we kind of needed to run that R move key, right? We still need to keep that value around. It just shouldn't go to the last add. So how are we going to deal with this case? And an observation you can make here is that to run this, we actually need to, kind of track two different versions of R8. And that's what we're going to do, is that we're dealing with register R8, we're going to say we're dealing with version 1 of register R8, or version 2 of register R8. So a way we can do this is that when I sort of take my code, I'm going to have a preprocessing step in my processor. When I take my machine code, I'm going to preprocess the instructions to mark what versions of registers we're using. So rather than having our processor deal with R10 and R8, we're going to say that we're dealing with R10 and R8 version 1 being read and R8 version 2 being written. And for the next instruction, we're going to deal with R8 version 2 being written, R8 version 2 being read, and R8 version 3 being written, and so on. And when doing our forwarding, we're not going to check, is this R8 being written by that instruction? We're going to say, is R8 version 2 being written? We're going to compare these version numbers for R8, rather than just R8. And another thing that this is going to help us with is that when we actually store to the register file, well, sometimes there's going to be these two different versions of R8. And in this example, which one should end up being stored? Yeah. So you're saying, okay, so we want to store the IR move cube. Yeah, so that's the one we want stored at the end. So can we get away with not storing the other versions of R8 here? And the answer is not quite. And why is the reason for that? Like, what's wrong with... So this version of R8 here, can we just not store it since we know this version will overwrite it? Yeah. So the problem is that if we look at this R8 here, right, we're storing R8 here, and this RMoveQ uses it, and the way it ended up executing, maybe because RAX wasn't available right away, it tried to read it after that prior RMoveQ instruction finished. So to execute this, it seems like we actually need the ability to store in our register file two different versions of R8 at the same time. That not only do we need to track the different versions, but we need to have storage in our register file for multiple versions. And this is essentially the solution that most modern processors use, that we're going to have that even though we might only have 16 registers in assembly, we're going to have a register file that stores like 100 registers to implement that, so we can store multiple versions of values. And I'm going to talk about sort of one strategy for this. This is not the only way of doing it, but we're going to have these lots of extra registers, and we're going to do something called register renaming, where as we load start instructions, we're going to take the register names that exist in the machine code in the assembly and convert them to new register names that are going to be unique for each version of that register. And in this way, we're going to avoid that problem of what if I have, two different versions of the values, how am I going to distinguish them? Well, after we do this preprocessing step, they're not going to be two different R8s. They're going to be, R52 and R53. They're going to look different completely because we've assigned different register numbers to them in this preprocessing step. So we're going to do this thing where we map what we call the architectural registers, that's the registers that are part of the instruction set architecture, to what I'll call physical registers. These are the actual registers and what will be a big register file. And we'll give a different physical register for each version of an architectural register. And this will also help us implement some other parts of our hazard handling. So one thing we wanted to do is we wanted to only run instructions when their values were ready. How can we tell if their values are ready? Well, this gives us a way of doing that. We can check whether the correct version of the register is ready. How do we check that? We just have a bit for each physical register saying, is it ready yet? Because we've assigned each version a different physical register. And while we're doing forwarding, we compare the physical registers. We know we're forwarding the correct version of the value because each version has its own physical register. And sort of this is sort of the central idea that we're going to use in sort of a modern processor design to actually handle these hazards. And so I'll give kind of a high-level diagram. This is kind of what the pipeline for a modern processor looks like. And we'll look at, in particular, how the rename parts of this and this instruction queue part of this work next time, and then relate that back to how can we make loops faster, right? We saw that these loops had this kind of plateau in performance. We'll see that, can we do better than that? And the answer is yes. But to understand why that's going to work, we're going to look at how this processor actually runs instructions. So in this processor, we have our fetch stage. We have a real decode stage, which like doesn't read registers. It like actually processes the instructions. And I have a whole bunch of branch prediction. So if we're fetching multiple instructions per cycle, our branch prediction becomes a lot more complicated and also a lot more important. Because previously, if like we didn't make the right prediction, we wasted two cycles. That was two instructions. If we're fetching, as many modern processors do, four instructions per cycle. If we waste two cycles, that's eight instructions. So these processors that implement this kind of pipeline tend to spend a lot of effort on branch prediction because the cost of a branch misprediction, or just failing to branch predict for a while, is a lot higher. Then we're going to have this register renaming step. So, and I've just here said, we're going to just have a pipeline stage for it. And that's going to convert our instructions to use these new physical register names. And then we're going to have this queue of instructions, along with information about what registers have their values ready. And we're going to have some machinery that looks at this queue and the list of ready registers and figures out which instructions can we actually run. And it's going to take them, and it's going to run them. And in this design here, I have one step to actually read their register value. So I have a register read stage, and this is going to talk to a big register file. And it's going to be big in the sense of having lots of registers, and also in the sense of being able to read and write a lot of registers at once. Why? Because, well, if we want to run, say, four instructions at a time, then we need to read eight registers at a time. So we're going to do that. And then we're going to send it to a bunch of what we'll call execution units. So the stuff that does the actual work for the instruction. So we'll have an ALU, but we won't just have one ALU. We'll have a bunch of them. And we'll have the data cache for instructions that access memory and so on. And often we'll specialize these. So for example, usually we think you probably don't actually care about running multiple divides in parallel because divides are kind of a rare operation. So maybe only one of these three ALUs will be able to do divides. And might do other things for other operations that are kind of rare, so we can devote less space in our processor to ALUs and still get basically the same performance because, your program's probably not going to be any slower if you can only do one divide at a time. So why waste the space letting you do that? And then we'll have a write back, and finally we'll have this new commit stage that figures out that finalizes instructions, and also importantly, lets us reuse the physical registers that are completely used, because otherwise we run out, right? If we're assigning a new register for each version, we run out eventually. How do we avoid doing that? When instructions are finished, we say, okay, no one's using this version of the register anymore. We can free that up to be used for something else. Okay. So next time we'll talk in detail about how this rename stage works, and we'll look through that. So we get a better idea of what the execution of these out-of-order processors looks like.